Okay, ladies and gentlemen, can I encourage you to take your seats? I know you've all had a long and exciting night probably in London, and well done for those of you who've made the early start. My name's Jane Anderson from Public Health England. I'm going to be chairing this first session, and it's a huge privilege. We've got three fantastic plenary speakers, and I'm going to start off by introducing you, although he needs very little introduction, to Professor Ken Mayer, who's going to give us the first talk on the state of the science, which is something I think we're all really very keen to hear Ken's take on. Ken is Professor at Harvard Medical School and the Harvard School of Public Health. He's attending physician at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. He's director of HIV prevention research, co-founder, co-chair, medical research director of the Fenway Institute, and looking at health policy. And he is looking at the largest ambulatory facility caring for HIV-infected patients in New England. So it's an enormous pleasure, with all your knowledge, all your experience, Professor Mayer, over to you.
Good morning, everyone. I'm really impressed that people are getting up at this hour, especially those of us on East Coast time. So I want to spend a little time talking about what's the rationale for PrEP. We heard some elegant discussions yesterday about treatment as prevention. So here we have a limited resource, antiretrovirals, expensive. Why are we even thinking about them for prevention? Well, one issue that came up yesterday is the fact that the definitive study, HB10052, actually had very few MSM couples, very few IDU couples. Biological plausibility is that treatment as prevention will work for these populations, but there may be mitigating circumstances such as the efficiency of anal sex that may mitigate the full benefit. And then, more importantly, in Western developed countries with a good healthcare system and a good regulatory environment around sexual gender minority civil rights, like here in the UK or in Denmark, there have been reports that despite access to antiretroviral therapy, the actual rates of new infections are increasing in the past few years. Similarly, in the United States, particularly among men who have sex with men. We also know that there are several key issues that are not resolved by the mantra of treatment as prevention. It takes time to scale up. There is stigma in terms of people's willingness to self-disclose and to negotiate the healthcare system if they are infected. And all these things will take time. And the modelers have suggested that it's not either or. In other words, both Tim Hallett here in London and Rochelle Walensky have suggested that in areas of very significant epidemics, the introduction of PrEP in addition to treatment as prevention can lead to a faster diminution in the number of new HIV infections. This is the scorecard of all the efficacy trials done to date. You can see here the efficacy estimate overall, the drug detection overall, and the estimated risk reduction. And you have a clear relationship that when people took the pills in a consistent way, there was a benefit that was achieved. Moreover, I think it's important to keep in mind that these are early days, so that there are concerns about PrEP, but they have not manifested in any significant way in the clinical trials. But the clinical trials are not necessarily the real world, and that's why it's so important to have efficacy studies subsequently followed by demonstration projects and finer refinement of the modality. So in terms of risk compensation, this was not seen in the trials, but people came in on a regular basis, received counseling. People who elect to go into clinical trials may not be people using the products in the real world. Renal insufficiency, people had to have a relatively normal renal function. As soon as the creatinine elevation was detected, drug was stopped. For example, in IPREX, there were 25 incidents where people had to stop because of a creatinine elevation out of the 1,750 or so individuals randomized to active medication. In 24 of the 25 times, medication was able to be restarted, and people did just fine. One person had to stay off medication because of recurrent increases in creatinine, but that normalized off of medication. So with careful monitoring, we're not seeing significant renal insufficiency in a healthy population. With regard to bone mineral density, there was a signal. It was statistically significant, but not clinically significant. But certainly in certain populations, adolescents, for example, women who are perimenopausal, one could imagine that bone monitoring may be an important part of monitoring if individuals are going to be taking daily oral tenofovir-based products. But obviously, less frequent dosing, if that's shown to be effective, may be a way to mitigate that potential concern. Transmission of resistance. Because there was substantial non-adherence in many of these studies, when people became infected, they tended to become infected with wild-type virus. The individuals who selected for resistance were individuals who were in the process of becoming acutely infected in the studies, who were viremic but were antibody negative when they initially were screened and enrolled in the studies. At their one-month visit, they were then antibody positive. Specimens were then checked from their initial visit, and they were indeed viremic. There were a small number of individuals who then manifested an M184V or other 184V mutations, in other words, a mutation to FTC or to 3TC. There was only one K65R detected in any of the thousands of individuals who have been studied so far. So again, in a controlled environment, we don't see selection of resistance, but if people are taking drug intermittently and not getting screened regularly, that would be a concern, but that has not been seen yet. Then we have to say that even from these initial trials, there are best-case scenarios. So these are data from Partners PrEP, and when they looked at multiple time points in terms of detection of drug in the blood, in the individuals where every time they looked at their blood sample, there was tenofovir detected in the blood, you can see 93.9% reduction in HIV transmission. So really a very strong correlation of adherence with efficacy of the approach. Moreover, there is a very recent publication this month in PLOS Medicine from Jessica Haber at Massachusetts General Hospital, who worked with the Partners PrEP team. And they had a sub-study in Uganda where they followed 1,147 couples. They intently followed these individuals, and when adherence dropped below 80%, they received enhanced counseling. This included problem-solving. They had unannounced home visits. They used the MEMS-CAP. And they found that in the subset of individuals, there were 14 seroconversions by the end of the study, and 14 participants who became infected were all randomized to placebo. So in other words, all the individuals who got the extra attention who were randomized to the active medication, none of them became HIV infected. We also saw, similarly, in IPREX, there were two U.S. sites, Boston and San Francisco. And looking at drug detection, it was really quite high, 97% of individuals in the U.S. sites, much lower at the international sites. Now, why is that? One would argue that if you were a man who had sex with men in Boston or San Francisco, there were plenty of options for prevention services, for testing, a lot of de facto medical incentives that might not be there if you were enrolling in the study, for example, in Peru. Even the amount of compensation just for attending the study visits might have been an incentive. So we have to think about the social environments under which people may or may not be engaging in PrEP. One big thing that jumped out was that adherence was much better with older individuals. And I'll show you a little bit of data from the IPREX open label study that raises the concern that people who may be a little less risky who are older may be more adherent. So we have to think about strategies for younger individuals. The other area in IPREX that I think is informative is that people are sentient human beings. People made decisions about how they were taking the pills, even though they didn't know if they were getting the active medication or placebo. If people reported unprotected receptive anal intercourse in the prior 12 weeks, drug was detected 76% of the samples. If they said that they hadn't had sex in the prior 12 weeks, only in about a third of the individuals, drug was detected. So this gets to the idea of, can we dose more parsimoniously since people may not be consistently risky? So in the IPREX open label study, not surprisingly, there was this gap period, and not surprisingly, people who reported having unprotected sex were more likely to become infected. But in counter-distinction to the initial IPREX study where older individuals were more adherent, here people who were younger were more likely to become infected. So clearly, we have to pay attention to developing strategies, particularly for youth, because they may be the individuals who may most benefit from chemoprophylaxis. Incident herpes simplex infection was associated with incident HIV infection, which is important. Unlike the CAPRISA 004 study, there was no benefit seen on HSV2 acquisition with oral tenofovir FTC. So whether that has a peculiarity of anal intercourse, we don't know, but we definitely did not see the secondary benefit Another issue which was borderline significant, but very important if we're dealing with the whole person who might benefit from PrEP, is that people who are depressed were more likely to become infected. So again, it's not just giving people a pill, but dealing with the circumstances under which they may be engaging in risk. We have some data from our open-label participation at Fenway Health. It's a large clinic focusing on sexual gender minority populations. So about half of the people who are in the IPREX initial study and the CDC safety study continued participation, so they all wanted to continue to get PrEP. And basically, we found drug detected, again, about 95% of the time. So the difference between the initial studies where people were randomized, they didn't know if they're getting active medication, we didn't know if the medication worked. There are clearly some populations of individuals who are highly motivated to take these pills on a regular basis at this point in time. Roger Tattoo here from Imperial College has put together a beautiful diagram, I think, which discusses all the different considerations we're all wrestling with now with the advent of PrEP and chemoprophylaxis. So there clearly are advantages, but how to give it, we still have questions about. Clearly there are challenges. There's certainly ethical issues, some of the issues about constrained resources and the importance of getting people who need antiretroviral therapy for treatment onto treatment first is certainly a relevant set of concerns. And then issues about eligibility. Who do we actually focus on for PrEP? And this is all a work in progress. And PrEP circa 2013 is not what PrEP will be like over the next 3-5 years. So we're just at a beginning. Jared Bate and Jessica Haber and Al Liu wrote a very nice article where they summarized some of the key scientific questions. So we still have questions about priority populations, about uptake, what, you know, who's really interested in PrEP? Is this something that is stillborn? It's just an idea that's really not going to take off? Or are we talking about something that needs time to disseminate and to diffuse to the people who might benefit the most? How to optimize adherence is a big question. This should be part of a sexual health strategy. So how do we use this as a tool to minimize potential risk? Certainly questions about long-term safety, the kind of safety data we have now, is still very limited. Certainly no one having substantially more than 3 or 4 years worth of experience with medication. Delivery systems are certainly important to know. And then ultimately, cost-effectiveness and cost-benefit to individuals. We talk a lot about a treatment cascade. So Dawn Smith and Al Liu have come up with a PrEP cascade. And I think what's an important part of the PrEP cascade is the role of providers, and we've really not paid enough attention now that PrEP is at least approved by several regulatory bodies. But clearly, the providers have to perceive themselves as taking care of high-risk individuals. They have to know something about PrEP and be willing to provide PrEP. And then, ultimately, the individuals who may benefit from PrEP have to have similar issues addressed before getting linked to a program and starting PrEP, being retained, and then achieving the maximal desired benefit. Here is a very busy slide, and I just show this to you as an example of the fine work that AVAC is doing in terms of keeping tabs on some of the active studies around the world. And some of these are still held up for ethics reviews, so not all these projects internationally are going on yet, but there certainly is a flurry of activity, some built as demonstration projects from the initial studies. There are an increasing array of studies now in the United States that are looking at different ways to deploy PrEP. And some of these are true demonstration projects. Some of them are new scientific inquiries. And I'll highlight a few of those in a minute. So the future of PrEP, there's NextPrEP, which is a study looking at maraviroc as an agent for PrEP. I'll tell you about that. Project ADAPT is HP10067. And this study is looking at event-driven versus fixed interval dosing, which is preferable for high-risk populations. It's important to note that we have proof of concept with one topical microbicide, the CAPRISO-04 study, and although we did not see efficacy in the VOICE study, there is a tiebreaker study, the FACTS study, that's underway, and if that study shows a successful result, we could see a rapid path towards licensure of a vaginal gel. And clearly, for individuals who engage in anal intercourse, the use of a lubricant that could protect them against HIV would be very desirable and relevant. And so we have to keep our eyes tuned to that. So MTN-017 is just beginning enrollment now. This is a study that will be enrolling men who have sex with men at several sites in the U.S., in Peru, in South Africa, and in Thailand, and will be essentially a phase 2 study and could pave the way for future efficacy trials. We've heard mention about injectable PrEP for treatment, and there are studies underway now in the HP10 looking at
long-acting rilpivirine, and there will be studies underway in the future looking at GSK744, an integrase inhibitor that similar to dolutegravir, also as an injectable PrEP. And then lastly, there are novel strategies to enhance PrEP, and you'll hear much more about that from Hervé Amico. But just very briefly, so what do we know about intermittent PrEP? Alu did a study called Project Strand where they actually looked at hair specimens, compared them to blood specimens, and the advantage of the study was that it was directly observed administration of oral tenofovir FTC. So the data from the levels that were obtained in Strand were compared to what was found in participants in IPREX. And among the 42 individuals who became HIV infected in IPREX who were randomized to tenofovir FTC, there were only three individuals who actually had detectable blood, so detectable drug in the blood. So in other words, three individuals out of the 42, the other 39 did not have medication and became infected. When you look at the drug levels here and you compare them to the directly observed range of concentrations, you can see that if you do the statistics with seven pills a week, so in other words, daily dosing, this would correlate to 99% protection. In other words, the vast majority of these individuals, almost all, were above the levels that these three individuals had achieved. Even with four times a week, in other words, every other day dosing, it came to about 96%, and even twice a week, around 76%. Now, this is not proof of concept that any of these more parsimonious dosing strategies work. It just is informative and provides a basis for future studies. So the one study I mentioned is HB10067. So this is enrolling high-risk women in Cape Town, men who have sex with men in New York, in Harlem, and in Bangkok. And it's basically looking at the preferability of a time-driven dosing schedule as opposed to an event-driven schedule. Are people more capable of gauging when they're going to be risky, that they're risky on a weekend and can build this into their routine, or does event-driven dosing make more sense? Another study that you'll hear more about is Epergay, and this study is enrolling men who have sex with men in several sites in France, in Quebec, and will be opening a site in Berlin, and has several hundred participants enrolled going forward. And this, again, is looking at pericoital dosing for men who have sex with men. Another study that was looking at a new medication for PrEP is HB10069. This study, all participants get three pills, either a placebo or active maraviroc, tenofovir, or FTC. So it's trying to look at comparable tolerability to see if one regimen is more tolerable, if one regimen is associated with higher levels of adherence, with the rationale that maraviroc, being an entry inhibitor, may be a favorable drug to consider for chemo prophylaxis. This study has fully enrolled the male cohort of 200 men who have sex with men at 12 sites in the United States, and about halfway enrolled the cohort of women participants in the study. Partners PrEP's demonstration project, I think, has some very important features, and you'll hear more about that. So this is trying to look at the question, for couples, does it make sense if they're serodiscordant for the infected partner to start treatment right away, for the uninfected partner to start PrEP, to have some combination thereof? And their early data is really quite interesting to see that initially PrEP only, because the infected partner is unsuppressed, but you can see gradual increase in the uptake of treatment and some diminution in the use of PrEP. So tracking over time which strategies work best for discordant couples when you have both modalities available is an extremely important question to look at. I mentioned youth concern about bone safety and also in terms of behavior. So there's been some work that has gone on in the Adolescent Trials Network under leadership of Sybil Hosek. She did an initial open-label study just looking at youth willingness to use PrEP and found that there was a reasonably high uptake in a sample of inner-city youth in Chicago. The adherence level was similar to some of the other PrEP studies. About 50% of the individuals had drug detected in the blood. So the question is how to enhance adherence for youth. So the Centers for Disease Control has several evidence-based interventions that are developed for youth. One of them involves a group set of group sessions called Many Men, Many Voices, a weekend retreat. The other one, personal cognitive counseling, involves individual counseling. And so the next study, ATN-110, and a follow-on study called ATN-113 for even younger youth, ages 15 to 17, is looking at whether the group counseling is more helpful for adherence or the individual counseling is more helpful for adherence for this population. Another area where we really have to pay attention, at least in the United States, is the fact that individuals who are members of dual minorities, who are sexual gender minority men of color, particularly black men who have sex with men, we're seeing a disproportionate share of new HIV infections in this population. And we've done earlier studies, HB 1061, which showed that there really needs to be culturally adapted services. So Daryl Wheeler, who's here at this conference, is the protocol chair with Sheldon Fields of a protocol which is now enrolling men in North Carolina, Washington, D.C., and Los Angeles, and trying to look if you can culturally adapt. And C4 is a client-centered coordinated care module, so that if you can develop services that address some of the other social service and individual psychological support needs that men of color have, whether you can get a better result in terms of PrEP uptake and PrEP adherence. You'll be hearing more from Sheena McCormick here in London about PROUD, which is a study that essentially is randomizing individuals to receive PrEP right away at genitourinary medicine clinics throughout the UK, or to be on a queue on a wait list, but to receive counseling and to see whether the counseling itself will modify behavior, or whether the counseling plus PrEP results in a much lower incidence of HIV. To tell you very quickly about some of the demonstration projects going on where there's more data, in San Francisco they initiated a project which is now expanded to Washington, D.C. and Miami. And they've developed a bunch of different messaging materials for their demonstration project. They're trying to sort of move PrEP out into the real world for their participants. The study involves a great deal of education. They've developed a bunch of user-friendly guides. These are available on their website, and they explain all the issues that people have to consider before initiating PrEP. The initial impressions that Al Liu shared with me are that people who begin PrEP feel that they describe less anxiety, better communication and disclosure with their partners, and more sexual pressure. But there is a lot of controversy about this approach. There have been blogs such as this one, Truvada Whores, that some of the individuals actually feel uptight about going on PrEP, or at least disclosing that they're using PrEP, about feeling the censure of their peers. So that's one set of issues we have to think about community perceptions actually having a negative impact. With my colleagues at Fenway Health, particularly Steve Saffron, we've been very focused on the fact that you can have these very simple models of disease prevention, but depression, anxiety, mental health issues, and substance use, which are very common in individuals who feel highly stigmatized as a sexual gender minority person, that these individuals interfere with individual uptake of PrEP. So we have an NIMH-funded study called Project Prepare. It's modeled after LifeSteps, which is a cognitive behavioral therapy counseling program to decrease HIV risk-taking in HIV-infected individuals. So we've adapted this for PrEP. It involves four sessions. There's a certain modularity because not everybody's depressed or not everybody's using substances. It involves a trained nurse to be working with the individual. And we use two technology fixes. One is that we use the WISE pill, so that we know every day if a person opened the pill box or not. And then we have text message communication with participants to see if they've engaged in sex. So we think that some of these technological approaches may actually help enhance PrEP adherence in the future. Another interesting study, Rafi Landowitz and Ray Amico, who we'll be talking to, are engaging in Southern California. And what's important about this one is that they're using serum tenofovir levels, and they're titrating the intervention based on if individuals enroll in the study and then do not have drug detected in the blood, then they get some additional counseling components. And again, the use of drug monitoring may be an important part of the future. So where are we in the real world? Well, the diffusion of innovation was, the theory was developed by agrarian sociologists, but I think it's very appropriate here with PrEP. I think we're at the innovators phase. In other words, there are individuals who are starting to use PrEP. We have to think about this diffusion of innovation very similar to zidovudine uptake. You can see in the gray after ACG-076 was published, and it certainly took time to get up to a high threshold of use even for this, which was a much less controversial innovation. We've worked with Manhunt, a social networking site, to do querying men who have sex with men in different states in the U.S. and different parts of the world. Our initial study found very little uptake, very little awareness, but lots of potential interest. We've also been serving providers who had substantial apprehension several years ago. There's work going on now to try to disseminate information about PrEP. So Project Inform in San Francisco has developed a series of educational media And some of them are testimonial. And another wonderful resource is my prepexperience.blogspot.com by Jim Pickett and his colleagues at AIDS Foundation of Chicago and the International Rectal Microbicide Alliance. And Irma put together these testimonials so people can hear from other people about what their experience has been like using chemoprophylaxis. There was a recent presentation last week at the ICAC meetings, which basically... was colleagues from Gilead looking at one pharmacy chain's records of prescriptions for HIV-uninfected people for what one would consider to be PrEP. They found almost 2,000 patients had accessed PrEP, and interestingly, almost half the users were women. Disproportionate number were from southern states in the U.S. I think these are important data to track, but I also think it's very important to note that in many urban centers in the U.S., there are demonstration projects that are focused on MSM, so there's still probably 10 or more fold greater number of MSM actually who are accessing PrEP at this point in time, but it does say something about the real-world practices. We did another recent study that was presented at the International Conference on AIDS in Asia and the Pacific, looking at social networking, same social networking site among Spanish and Portuguese-speaking men who have sex with men. And the good news and the bad news about using social media is that you can get a huge N. We had 33,000 individuals in our final sample, but you can say generalizability, that was out of a potential membership of 643,000 individuals. But nonetheless, I think it's very interesting, looking across the different countries, we found that the two countries where there was the highest awareness of PrEP were Brazil and Peru, which happened to be places where the IPREX study was conducted. So that's interesting, but we didn't see really significant difference in terms of the prevalence of use, in, only about a 1% range. And again, potential interest was high, particularly in Latin America, somewhat less so in Europe, and that would be very interesting to understand where the skepticism in one part of the world comes from compared to other parts of the world. There are a number of other studies that have been recently published in AIDS and Behavior, looking at other populations. Similar themes, very little use so far, lots of potential interest in this approach. Here at this meeting, I just call your attention to a variety of posters so that I think there's a lot of opportunities for people to have conversations with some of the poster presenters during the lunch break to be able to think more about what's going on with this approach. These are recent data from our own clinic at Fenway Health looking at non-trial individuals accessing PrEP, and you can see a gradual uptick. And actually, if I update the slide, we've had probably 20 more individuals who've used PrEP over our summer months. So there is an inexorable increase in usage. The last piece of the puzzle are providers. I have a colleague, Douglas Krakauer, who's a new career investigator, very interested in doctor-patient communication. So over the past year, he's done qualitative studies of physicians in Boston, has had focus groups, and has tried to use a structured approach to this, an inductive approach to the analysis. And these are just two kinds of themes. On one hand, there's a lot of perceived efficacy, at least in Boston with a fairly sophisticated medical community. Providers know that this does work. But then something he called the purview paradox, which I think is a perfect expression. There's a lot of this going on, a lot of providers who are HIV specialists saying, well, you know, I don't take care of people who are not HIV infected, so that should be the generalist taking care of them. And a lot of the generalists saying, I'm not an expert in using these medications. It really should be the specialist taking care of them. So I think we have a real challenge to figure out who in the workforce will be most comfortable providing these medications. The Infectious Disease Society of America has an emerging disease network, and they did a poll over the past year of the population of providers, and actually found that a substantial number have provided PrEP, 9% of the providers. The majority did support the idea of PrEP, but still there were substantial concerns. Certainly issues such as risk compensation were mentioned. So where are we today? I think we've got proof of concept established. The scientific questions, there are still some that remain, and certainly implementation science questions are very important. The next steps are to develop and test the interventions to optimize PrEP delivery, and we have to keep in mind the drugs, the dosing intervals, and the delivery systems may continue to change. And PrEP has to be seen holistically. So we're talking about combination antiretroviral prevention that has to also incorporate understanding issues like depression, substance use, relationship dynamics if we're going to have an effective rollout of this modality. So I just want to thank many colleagues whose information helped contribute to this talk and welcome you to visit Fenway Health, particularly if you're at CROI next year. Thank you.